Hello, and welcome to the Naked Englishman podcast. It's Tuesday, the 1st of September, 2026, on what appears to be a overcast morning. And there is a bit of blue sky, which I'm very pleased about. I'm recording on my Zoom, as I often do, and stupidly, I didn't format the card. So if this suddenly stops, the card I've got doesn't have a huge amount of space and I forgot to erase the previous recording. So if it just suddenly stops, you'll know why. And I just thought I'd alert you to that beforehand. Anyway, I wanted to talk today about a particular talk that I heard yesterday. Julia and I went to the Hope Sussex Festival, and that, for those that don't know, Hope Sussex is a community-based homeschooling hub, and it's down near Battle in East Sussex. It's a lovely place, lovely community. I've made a couple of videos about it, and we support them in not so much in financial ways, but by giving talks. And yesterday I was emceeing, Master of Ceremonies, bringing people on in their talk tent. And they had music and various stalls, you know, sort of things that you get at a festival, and also a tent of interesting and inspiring talks. And I was, as I say, I was bringing people on and bringing people off and listening to the talks while we were there. And there was a lady called Andrea Mannell who gave an interesting talk on what it is to be sovereign. And she brought this subject from a slightly different perspective to the usual sovereign talks, in which people often often refer about, you know, where authority comes from and the fact that we are, as human beings, if you like, sovereign people, and we always go through life asking permission or seeking permission, and how we've been brought up to feel that we need to have permission to do things all the time. Now, she did touch on this, but what I thought was fascinating was a slightly different approach, which is always refreshing, I think, because within the, let's call it the truth community, those people who are inquiring about what they see as presented to them as life and the system that we find ourselves in, and question whether that's really what life is about. And many people will have heard me talk, as I have interviewed various people over a 3-year period on the YouTube channel, exploring different aspects of truth and what is true and what isn't necessarily true, and what a mainstream narrative has been portraying. And to a greater or lesser degree, I think we fall into a trap of accepting what we are given and believing that that is the only way to live. And because we observe how everybody else lives, we assume that that's the only way to live. And it takes perhaps a bit of a leap to step aside from that, to perhaps question it and say, well, is this really the only way to live? And I'm not necessarily talking about living in houses in a town and going to work and coming back. I mean, that's obviously part of it. I've got to try and get into my mind the order that she was talking about, because she was She was talking more from the very fact at the beginning of our lives, in the first, from naught, once we're born, to say five. And we all, I suppose most people are aware that these are our most important years to form what will be with us for the rest of our lives, our opinions and our attitudes. And a lot of people, of course, in this day and age, are being born with a certain amount of trauma. Now, she explained when she was talking about trauma that she wasn't talking about necessarily big, dramatic things like having your parents die in a car crash or having limbs removed or having accidents or being in a house fire or anything, you know, majorly dramatic. That doesn't happen to the vast majority of people, fortunately, but of course it does happen. And there are very traumatic things. But in her instance, for example, when she was born, she related how, through the best will in the world, the nurses had, they thought that once the baby was born, in her case, her, once she was born, her mother was very tired and exhausted. And so, in order to give the mother rest, they took the baby from the mother and would care for it in another room, or even in a cot beside her. But as she related, from a baby's perspective, you're with the mother for the 9 months that you are in her, in the womb, and once you come out, you've had the trauma of being born, which is a dramatic event in and of itself that we all go through, whether that is through natural birth or through a caesarean. And what you at that point need is the reassurance, the love and the care, and of course the importance of being fed from your mother, which all other animals do, and we do. And you know, you need that comfort to be with your mother, hear the heartbeat, feel the warmth of the skin, and of course drink your mother's milk. But as I say, in her case, and in the case of many people, if it's been a long and drawn out birth, the mother can be quite exhausted, that she may be on various drugs which has helped her give birth, let's say, but also then made her tired. And as she explained, in the best will in the world, she, as a baby, was removed from her mother so that her mother could just have a bit of a rest. But from the baby's point of view, that is, of course, a bit of trauma, because suddenly you are removed from all your experience of what life is up until that point. There's many people that don't believe that the baby is that cognitive at that point, except that we do know that babies, of course, cry for many reasons, and they can't articulate their feelings. They cannot explain what is upset with them. They just can reveal at that point they're not happy. And so for a baby to be crying or taken away and separated from what they feel is actually them, because that they're in no way at that stage to understand that they are not a separate being. And it takes quite a few months, I think she said 8 to 12 months, for a baby to realize that they are not part of the mother, because they were part of the mother. As you can imagine, they're not sitting in the womb going, well, I can't wait to be born and get on and, you know, do the things I want to do. They have no concept of anything. And so this process can be a trauma, and yet it's not in the eyes of the nurses who are looking after the baby, or in many people's eyes, a traumatic event. But from the baby's point of view, it is. We get over that, of course, But these things stay in the subconscious and are part of us, and we live through them. And she was explaining, although I don't fully understand, but in these first few years, let's say, we are given to believe a number of things, and these things build up the core of us, which we don't realize. It's, as I say, it's deeply in our subconscious. We don't realize that these minor traumas are being played out and give us certain reactions and potentially fears. We are brought up in a world of fear. And as we grow up, we are fearful. And so this is where this sort of, you know, permission to do things comes in. We are sent to school and we're given certain rules and regulations, which of course suit the organisations, because they don't really want children running around, and many of these rules and regulations are there for the baby's benefit, you know, not to run in front of cars and not to put your fingers into the mains and get electrocuted, or not to walk off a cliff and things like that. But others are purely organisational, to enable a group of people to corral, I suppose, children and take them from one place to another, or to try and instill the values and experiences that grown-ups wish to entrust in the children, I suppose. But now some of these are unavoidable, of course. Nobody wants their child to be injured or hurt or go astray, and they do want to give family values, and that's right and proper, of course, in a family. But these things, she was saying, stays with us, and often we lose and can lose our sense of wonder, of joy, and finding out things for ourselves, because we become very dependent on certain adults to guide us and show us the way. Anyway, so as you grow up, these things, she says, plays out, and these mini traumas can come back to haunt us. So that you, in her case, as she said, you know, just talking to a room of people about what she wanted to talk about, she would start to feel various fears. You know, will they laugh at her? Will they listen? Will they sit still? Will they moan? Will they scowl and give her disapproving looks and things like that? And it's simple, I say simple, but they're not really simple, but things like confidence can very easily be thwarted from your experience as a child, and it takes a lot to get over these things. So that was, you know, something that I've identified in myself in my upbringing, of how not so much when I was a baby, because I can't remember really being a baby. I remember just a few vague memories, images really, that are almost like snapshots as a young lad, but a lot of that is gone, but it's still there. That's the point she was trying to make out. And of course, our parents have gone through the similar sort of mini traumas, if you like, and that has fashioned them so that when they have children, they can often add to or bring their traumas into the newborn babies. Now, what she wasn't trying to do was to say, you know, somehow or other, you avoid all these things, because it is very much part of life. But part of the life is learning to understand that that's going on inside you, and that you relearn, if you like, how to cope with life. So the sovereign bit was realizing, and I'm trying to remember how she put it, and how she dealt with it, really, which I'm scrabbling around here to try and bring this back, because I haven't made any notes or anything. I mean, I listened to it all make perfect sense, and I thought this would be an interesting thing to talk about. And of course, I can only colour it with my own perspective as well. But I'm just trying to get to the nub of this, and that's not it's not so easy, actually, as I first thought it would be. She talks about the fact that we get into fear, and we are fearful of things happening. I mean, some of them, of course, are irrational fears. I mean, extreme fears, like when you get into a car, you might feel, oh, we're going to have an accident. If you've had some sort of accident before, dangers that you think. I mean, we all, for example, a natural one would be to be fearful of the dark and believe that there is some menace hiding behind every tree or in the bushes or that sort of thing. And as we grow up, a lot of these fears are actually perpetrated to us. Now, to a certain degree, of course, you could argue that being wary of things, if you were walking in the dark, you might be wary of problems and potential dangers, of course, and it's natural to be on your guard for those sort of things. But some things get blown out of proportion, and I think that's where she was going, and it's building that confidence in oneself, allowing oneself to do things rather than all the time having somebody else hold our hand. Where she went with this, though, is really about how we live our lives. She was talking about, firstly, we are creatures that have emotions, and these emotions can dominate us, and often we believe that we are the emotions. So a number of people will say, when things aren't going right for them, they might say, I am depressed. Now, they might not mean the clinical version. They might just use that in a sort of flippant way, but it still expresses how they feel to a degree. You know, they don't feel great, they feel depressed. And one of the things you were saying, yes, you know, we often own these emotions as if they are us. I don't know if you can hear that. That's a church bell somewhere. Oh, just two chimes. Well, it's not 2 a.m, I can tell you that. So I found that very interesting. So she was saying that we need to understand that we're not the emotion itself, we just are. We have this identity that we believe that we are, which very much, for me, chimes into the name. The name is a hugely important aspect of this. When we're born, I mean, this is my attitude, when we're born, we're not given, we're not born with a name. We're born. We are an entity in our own right. We may well be part of the universe. We may be part of, however you wish to express that, it may be part of the source, part of God, part of whatever, or we may be the entirety of God, as in a drop of water is made up of the same kind and quality of water as say the big ocean, but we are a little droplet with our own personality and our own ego. So she was saying that sovereignty is in the heart, and that the mind that does all the thinking is very much the ego. And I can only take what she says and then put my own interpretation on it, so I'm not giving what she said verbatim, because I think when you listen to something, you encapsulate it with your own thoughts as well, to try and understand, or your understanding comes from a combination of what somebody is explaining to you plus your own experiences and thoughts. But it made sense to me that the mind, of course, is the organization. It wants to do things, and it wants to be practical, and it's problem solving and those sort of things. Whereas the heart, that she said, whispers to you. We don't hear it because we're so wrapped up in ourselves and our supposed identity. And this is where, for me, the name, it is only a label. It is something that we will use as a way to get our attention. It isn't in and of itself us. The problem is, of course, when you go to school, the whole system, whether one believes it's been rigged that way or not, and I happen to believe it has been rigged that way, part of the system is to brainwash you into believing that you are both the first name and surname, which, for those that follow a more perhaps conspiratorial understanding, will realize that that is part of control, and that we get registered, we have to be registered, you know, in the system. And then if we live by those names that have been registered, which is the legal fiction, because it doesn't really exist, and we have letters from government telling us we have to do this, that and the other, and you become a player in a game, or rather you become the character in a game, and you go into the whole capitalization of names and all of this, of how government authorities will deal with you, and the whole corporate identity that we fall into a trap and believe that we are. But that's not sovereignty. She was dealing much more with an emotional side of it, and saying that when we feel the fear, we ought to lean into the fear and let it, I suppose, to a degree, wash over us, so that we can understand what that fear is doing to us, rather than reacting to the fear, whatever it might be, particularly in the area of authority. But it doesn't have to be in authority. As somebody else pointed out, you know, one can be embarrassed by something. Somebody says something about you, whether it might be, I don't know, your size, the colour of your hair, or whatever, and you might be fearful that you're going to be laughed at or poked fun at, and or even segregated because of that. And the fear of that is overwhelming. And her point really was that to be in control of your sovereignty, of who you are, you should lean into it, let the experience, without doing anything, if you, you know, just understand that this is just an emotion and it will pass. And once you do this, you lose the fear. Half the time we're fearful of things because we're fearful of them. And that holds us back. And once you've experienced the fear in a private way, and the more you do it, the less it has agency on you or has an ability to disrupt you. Because often we know, just from life experience, don't we? We fear things, we do the things. So let's say, you know, you're asked to read a section of prose at school, or you're in front of a group and you've got to talk about something and you can be very fearful. But when you do it, it's not as bad as you first thought. And we've all had those things where we go, oh God, I really don't want to do this because I'm fearful of all the various things that might go wrong. And we start to build up a cacophony of problems for us that haven't even happened. People move into that area of fear and worry about whether something isn't going to go right, or whether we're wearing the wrong clothes. You know, just on a simple scenario, we get very fearful about things, of how people are going to react. And then in the event, a lot of these sort of minor fear things do not actually transpire, and we often think, golly, I don't know why I was so worried about this. But those, excuse me, those fears, she sort of implied, comes from those early days. There's nothing you can do about that because you were born and you were a child and you were a baby, and that first 5 years, certain aspects of life are kind of programmed into you. And so to try and become more sovereign and in control and lead a better life for yourself, we need to understand what those, not so much the exact events that happened, but how to deal with them when they come. And her point was that you lean into the fear and let it wash over you. You don't put yourself into a fearful situation. She's not saying that. You don't, but you can sit and think about or allow that fear of something to happen so that it becomes less fearful. You know, I don't know whether I'm making any sense. This is one of the problems of trying to relay somebody else's talk. As I say, I can only colour it with my own experience. But then once you no longer have the fear, and we shouldn't be fearful creatures. We have natural elements of self-preservation, which is one thing, and one can prepare for that. So you're going to take a walk in the dark down a lane, you would think, well, I'll take a torch so I don't bump into brambles and trees and shrubs and things. You know, you can make practical solutions. But if you imagine that we were blind, somebody who is blind only knows darkness, and so wouldn't have that fear of light and dark in the same way that we do. And so she's saying that basically you can overcome a lot of these things by allowing the fear to get into you, and then gain that sovereignty in yourself, that sort of confidence. And then you move into the world of authority. And this is where the schooling and the local authorities, government, and the system, if you like, of life starts to dictate to us how we can live. and you start to think, is this the only way to live? And of course it isn't, but there is a whole system in place to keep people to a larger and lesser degree in their place, and it is of benefit to others that we remain controllable. And so then you start to, you know, we get into this business about we feel that we have to ask permission. And yet, when you really think deeply about this or allow your heart to open up and give you its wisdom, you realize, of course, that we're all born equal. We're all born on this earth, whatever it is, you know, and everyone's got a different viewpoint. We're all born into a world, and a bunch of people have decided this is how you're going to live. And that's not necessarily right for you. Some people are quite happy to live by rules and regulations and find that comforting to a certain degree. Other people don't wish to live in the way that somebody else has decided that that is how you should live. And I think you start to move into what is ethical and what is morally right. You know, being sovereign doesn't mean that you can go and trespass, or that you can take from other people. You know, there's the sort of, we've all got to live together. And then there'll be, I suppose, certain ways of living, let's say, rather than rules, but certain ways of living that make sense to most people. And I guess a lot of those have been talked about within the Christian faith. You know, love thy neighbour, and they have their commandments about, you know, do not commit murder and things like that, which of course makes sense, unless of course it's self-preservation, and that's, it's either you or them, and you've got to make that choice when you're in those sort of situations. But we're living more and more now in a controlled environment where rules and regulations just got out of hand, where you can be, let's say, just in your car traveling from one place to another, and instead of using the road and driving in a sensible way, which might occasionally mean speeding up a bit for safety's sake to get past somebody who is driving perhaps a little erratically, and you think, I'd rather be in front of him than behind him, because if they suddenly brake or they don't look safe, I'm going to get past them. And we're in a situation that if you're driving in a safe manner and you happen to overtake somebody on a motorway, a camera can flash and say, well, you've gone past what we deem the correct speed for this road. And then you've got to either start to argue with authority about what was happening. And in the past, I think that was possible to do. But now, so much of what we find is really about collecting money and oppressing people and making them fearful to have any agency of their own. And this is where I think the rules and regulations that we find are beginning to lose perhaps their original intent. I'm being very polite here. Some people will, listening to this, or if they were listening to this, would be saying, Richard, we don't, you know, we shouldn't have any of these. I mean, there are certain things that make sense to me. For example, in this country, we all drive on the left-hand side of the road. And if we all abide by that simple decision, we're not, on the whole, going to collide with another vehicle that is coming in the opposite direction, because they'll be driving on their left-hand side, which would be our right-hand side, of course, and so we can pass very easily. And so a simple rule, if you like, is there. But these rules should be, you know, you should be able to break those rules in terms of driving, let's say, more safely. But with the attitude of the authority now, you can't do that because there's cameras and there's all the business about trying to, you know, oppress you, give you 3 points and for every misdemeanor that you might do. And these misdemeanors are somebody else's decision. And of course, it's being taken out of even the human decision. It's all done by computer, by AI, and there's no leeway anymore. There's no human that's making the decisions. It'll go to various courts, and in many cases you don't get your day in court, you don't get to argue, you don't they'll say, well, this is the rules and this is how it's done, and your sovereignty is then taken from you. And this is not, in my mind, a great way to live. And it makes people, I think, it makes people become more selfish. And you break rules for different reasons rather than good moral reasons. And so, I mean, that might be a strange example, but just trying to sort of put into words what she was getting at, really. And one can go further and further deeply into this, but I probably need to sort of think and get bullet points down to be able to express it more clearly. But ultimately, you know, it comes down to, I repeat this and I talk about this quite a bit, you know, who we are and what we are, and not what a organisation or an authority wants to make us into. And then you connect with that fear, and that fear prevents you from enjoying your life. And it seems to me that this experience on this earth, whatever it is something that we should be enjoying and getting as much pleasure out of as possible. That's not to say, of course, that challenges shouldn't be there. Of course they should. I think when you meet a challenge and you solve the problem and you move on to another challenge, there is that not only are you learning, of course, but there's a certain element of confidence that builds within you, and you become, you know, wow, I did that, I managed to achieve that, how that's great, and you go on. It's not a question of being prideful, if that's the right word, or having pride and going, oh, look at me, I'm, you know, aren't I clever. It's just you've met those challenges and you're confident then about other challenges, and you build on those challenges, and away you go. And that gives you a certain joy. With Julia and I, at the moment, with our land, we are facing all sorts of different challenges. We've not really grown food in the way that we're doing it here, with veg patches and polytunnels and collecting water. And we've had a manipulated weather system put upon us. I think that has been deliberately manipulated. Some people will laugh at that, and other people will say, well, you know, we did have hot summers in the past, but we also had thunderstorms and rain. And I think that, as people will know, that this is, of course, just to enforce more and more the doctrine that we're living in a world that is, again, a fearful world, because there is this thing that they've labelled global warming, man-made global warming, and of course it's all our fault, and we shouldn't live with the things that we do live, and so we have to be penalised and have all the net zero policies, which when you look at them, they don't make a lot of sense. And they seem counterintuitive anyway, a lot of them. So I think that has. And then also when you look and you see the patents for weather manipulation that go back, I think, to the late 1800s or 1900s. No, 1800s in the 19th century. And you see that these patents have been applied, that people have been fiddling about with chemicals in the atmosphere, and now they're very advanced. We know about the HAARP institution that can manipulate all sorts of weather patterns. And if it's, you might say, well, that, surely that's for the good, isn't it? But it depends who's got the knob, who's controlling those things, and everyone's got their bias. And it does seem to be the case that you or I never get a chance to have a go and manipulate the weather. It's always somebody else in power. It's always, they say, done for our benefit. And then you think, well, it doesn't appear to be. And of course, we know that those people in power generally don't have our benefit in mind, because you can see how a government like the Labour government, when it came in, one of the first things it did said, we will take away the winter payments from pensioners. And you think, well, that's a bit of a strange old thing to do. Why would you do that? And then, of course, more and more policies seem to be more penal and anti-human. And it was looking at those sort of things that got me to go down the rabbit hole and look at a number of things and realise, of course, that we have been ensnared and our sovereignty very subtly taken away from us, our agency, that you need to have permission to do anything these days. And I question, where does that authority come from? Why is it that a bunch of people who you can't influence, that you can't have any say-so, will decide what is right and wrong for you? And even now, you know, there's a so-called wellness and schooling bill that has been passed, and the government really doesn't want children to be homeschooled, or if they are homeschooled, they want them to stick to the government's curriculum. And again, this is taking the agency or the sovereignty away from mums and dads who want to bring up their children, how they want to bring them up, with the values they want to bring them up. I think it's absolutely wrong that a single individual in a classroom is then putting over a government curriculum of ideas, telling them how you should live, telling them what they believe to be true, or what they want us to believe to be true, and not allowing the young minds to question not only facts, but also question ethics and morals and what's right and what's wrong and what should happen and what shouldn't. And that is, to me, it is the way of controlling a nation in a negative fashion. And it all comes back down to one's individual sovereignty. One of the biggest things that we are distracted from continually, and more so now than ever before with mobile phones and screens and things, is we are led to worry about things going on in parts of the world or in other parts of the same country that we have no control over. It doesn't actually immediately affect us, but we're fearful of it, and we're put continually into this place of fear, and that is a detrimental it is detrimental to us as people and as sovereign individuals, because we're distracted by things that we're worrying about. You know, we're kept in a state of fear, and we have to have permission. And we saw that more than ever with the COVID situation, in which a government suddenly said, right, these are your freedoms, these are your restrictions, this is what you can do, this is what you can't do, and we want you to take a drug, rightly or wrongly, but we want you to take it. And then the herd mentality of very fearful people started to turn on their friends and neighbours by saying, you must obey, you must do this. And we saw effectively what to me was like in the English Civil War, people turning on their own family if they had a different opinion from what was the mainstream opinion, and were questioning facts or so-called facts, and questioning the efficacy of taking a substance which perhaps may not be to our best advantage, hadn't had proper testing, and the goalposts were moving all the time. We all remember, of course, that just checking whether we're still recording. Yeah, we all remember that. Hopefully, we remember that originally the so-called vaccine was there for the over 80s, and then very quickly it became everybody. It just came down that you know, if you were in your 60s, you better have it, then the 50s and 40s, until it came to pregnant women and children, at which point, fortunately, it was stopped. But the inference was still there that you had to have it. And we saw companies saying, no jab, no job, which was ridiculous. You weren't given the agency. You were given these false beliefs that this was actually going to save humanity. And yet the facts soon came out that it didn't prevent the very thing it was supposed to prevent. And, you know, the whole case was just so ridiculous. But we found that the whole situation brought huge amounts of fear for a lot of people, and they went with it, and reason went out of their heads, that the reason was made for them. And that was very sad, because those that have actually looked and examined what was in the vaccine found that actually, even if you're kind about it, even if you're putting a positive spin on it, the substances in it were detrimental to human life, and we've been suffering those consequences. If you look at it in much deeper, you realise that the whole thing was a psyop. There's a wasp flying around the microphone and myself. And it was not something that people should have taken, and they needed to have had more agency to be able to say that. There's so much one can say, really, on sovereignty and what it means and how one can get out, of the system of fear and control, but I haven't really got time in this one to talk about it. But sadly, I'll end with this. We're in a situation now, and I think more than any other time, because of the brainwashing, that people are not open-minded anymore. People cannot listen to somebody else's point of view if it differs from theirs. They can't say, well, that's your point of view, it's interesting, thank you for sharing, I disagree with that, and then still remain friends. We've become so polarized that if you don't believe the way I believe, then you're an idiot. And this has been very much rolled out. I mean, and people in what they call power, whether that's government officials, celebrities, ex-prime ministers, who during the COVID said, if you don't take the vaccine, you are an idiot. It's not right. Everybody should have the agency to be able to say, look, I've looked at it. It's not for me. You know, you take it if you want to, but it's not for me. And that should be the case for a lot of things. And as I say, there's more to be said on all of this. But I think we need to reappraise why we're frightened and why we're continually asking permission and why we do that. And do we need that permission to do certain things in this life that we're all born equal to, and nobody is born any better than anybody else? And that is a quest which I think more than ever at this particular time, as we're beginning to reach crisis points after crisis points, that we need to listen to our hearts and know what is right and what is wrong. Thank you for listening. I will talk to you soon.